Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bob Elson. We're set as usual for our Sunday morning show. And remember, today at Wrigley Field, Chuck Tanner's Pittsburgh Pirates make their final appearance of this series here. Used to be a team would go into a city four times, but now I believe it's twice or three times in the night. Yeah, in your own division. Pittsburgh's got a tough club. They got off to a slow start simply because they've had a lot of pitching problems. But there have been a lot of surprises already in baseball. Well, Cincinnati, for one. Minnesota's been a big surprise. They were expected to wind up in the cellar after they got rid of Carew, and they've been playing very well. Sox will be playing today. You can hear that game on radio. I don't think it'll be televised from California. And the Cub game, of course, with Pittsburgh will be on radio and on TV. We're going to talk baseball today with an old partner of mine, one of the country's really great baseball announcers, Milo Hamilton of Pittsburgh. He and I had four wonderful years together. We had a lot of fun, a lot of good time, a lot of laughs. And I really miss him, but it's always great to see him and to see him doing so well. And one of these days, here's a guy who went around the country plugging for me to get into the Hall of Fame. Between him and Brickhouse, I think I really smothered the airwaves in every city. And anyway, I'm going to get in, as you know, on August the 5th, and Milo will get in one of these days, and Jack will get in one of these days, too. I know that because I know they're on the list of 12 that are headed for the Hall of Fame, so I hope it happens to him soon. Anyway, we'll talk baseball with Milo. He'll be with us in just about 1 minute. We're delighted to have Milo Hamilton with us today. He is one of the top broadcasters in the country and the top broadcaster for Pittsburgh, a dangerous club. You know, Milo, strangely enough, looking at the standings, I know, because you told me about you fellows having pitching trouble, a lot of the experts picked Pittsburgh to win the division.
Well, I think the way we finished last year got a lot of people on our bandwagon, Bob. You know, we started from way back, and I think the last 6 weeks of last season, we were the best team in the National League. And when you start that far back and only miss by a game or a game and a half, you've really made a run at it. We really got hot. Everything fell into place. We had a lot of speed, and we had a lot of pitching, and we had a lot of power. And we just made a heck of a run at the Phillies, and we lost it on the next to the last day and really gave them a chase. And we thought maybe that would really give them the punch to go on and win the National League pennant. But, of course, you know, the Dodgers beat them again. And then over the winter, we felt that our club, with the pitching we were going to take to spring training, and even in spring training we felt that our pitching was going to be the best that it had been in years. And Rooker got hurt. In fact, he's going to pitch for the first time this afternoon. And it's possible that, you know, if we'd have had Rooker, that would have stabilized your starting. But you had to put somebody else in the rotation a couple of times. Blylevin, who, as you know, you saw him in the American League. What a great pitcher he is. Many think he might have the best curveball in all of baseball. He hasn't won a game yet and has started nine times. If you and I had bet that on Vegas on opening day, we wouldn't be doing this show today. We'd be on a world tour someplace, all expenses paid, that a guy with that stuff would not have won a game yet. And also, we'd get some good starting pitching and maybe have the score tied or be leading by a run, and then on that particular day, the bullpen wouldn't be able to hold him. And Kent Tekulve, who, you know, last year set records for our club, 31 saves, 91 appearances, and this year he's had a little trouble getting going. Now, the last three or four times, he looks like the Tekulve of last year. So, as you know, when you don't get good pitching, then it makes other things magnify.
You know, while you're talking about pitching, it's a good time to ask you this question. We both know that the Dodgers draw over 3 million people a year. They lead the majors in attendance. We know that Walter O'Malley has got money buried in under the floor in every room of his 40-room estate. Now, how...
He ought to be bringing it here.
Yeah. How could Walter O'Malley, knowing that pitching is that important, give up a pitcher like Tommy John? And that, I think, is going to cost them the pennant.
Well, it very well could, Bob. You make a very good point. It's hard to believe. Not only do they draw 3.5 million people, which is a world's record, but they also own the place. They get all the concessions and all the parking. You know, today in this age, a lot of clubs don't share in the concessions. They don't get the parking. So they got it coming in under the transom and over the transom out there. And I just kind of feel, and the way they talked, that they just felt, well, maybe Tommy John has had his great years. We can do it without him. I think they got a little false impression last year when they saw Welch. And he was, boy, he can throw, you know.
He could, yeah.
And I think they thought maybe he could step in. Well, he hasn't been able to. At that time, also, they had no idea that Terry Forster was going to have an elbow operation. And what a job he did for them last year. Well, you know, he hasn't thrown a ball yet. I think if they'd have known those two things, that maybe Welch wasn't quite as good as their first impression was, together with the fact that Forster wasn't going to be able to pitch the first two or three months of the season, they might have opened up that bank book a little bit and kept Tommy John.
You know, the deal they made, Roden for Rao finally won a game for him. He pitched a terrific game the other day.
That was Royce with us.
Oh,
Jerry Royce.
Royce.
Yeah. That was a case of two players feeling that they weren't being used correctly. Both made it known they pretty much wanted to be traded. In fact, you know, Royce almost came to the Cubs last year. But with some of these rules, if you've been with a club so long, you can, or if you have it in your contract, you can turn down a trade. He turned down the trade. He didn't want to come here. So, and he had a good spring training for us. But at that time, it looked like our starting rotation was set. He wasn't going to start. He felt that he was still a starting pitcher. So, when it came a chance, and Roden pretty much felt the same way. He'd been a starter with the Dodgers, had been a good one. And all of a sudden, he wasn't pitching, and it was a case of two players still feeling they ought to be starting pitchers that wanted to be traded, so the two clubs got together on the deal. Royce has gone out there, and he hasn't been starting, but has had a couple of pretty decent relief appearances. But Roden's been hurt. He's pitched one game for us. In fact, he went on the disabled list the day before we came here on this series. And we don't know when he's going to be able to pitch. It's something in the back of his shoulder. He's been examined countless times. They can't find any damage there. In other words, it's almost a case after you've been examined so many times and they say we don't find anything, you almost wish they'd find something so they'd know how to treat it.
Yeah.
But he's never had any problem. He can't ever remember hurting it. Sometimes, you know, when a pitcher's throwing, he'll hear something pop or a tear.
Yeah.
Well, now the trainer and the doctor and everybody else knows what they're looking for and how they're treating it and how long it's going to take. But it's been the back of his shoulder. He pitched in Atlanta 2 weeks ago and was pitching very well, had good stuff, and a rain delay. Now, here's a guy trying to come back from an injury, had to warm up twice again because of two rain delays, and they think that just set him way back again. So he's on the disabled list, and he's just going to have to build the strength back up in there and hope that it's just a weakness rather than some serious injury.
What do you guys in the National League hear about Sparky Anderson?
Well, you hear something every day that he's going somewhere. I guess if you were going to take an outside bet, you'd say maybe he's going to end up as the Yankee manager next year. But you can't. I think he's so happy doing what he's doing. He's kind of doing what we're doing today. He's going around the country doing TV shows for a station in Los Angeles. I know he missed it the first day because that was the first day in years that he hadn't been at a ball game on opening day in some capacity with a uniform on. But I think that phase has passed him by now. And I think Sparky will be back because he's a good manager. He knows how to handle people. He has the respect of his players. And did you ever hear the story of how he got fired?
No.
Well, you know, Sparky was very adamant on 2 points. He wanted to trade Geronimo, the center fielder, because he felt that he wasn't giving them what they needed, either with his bat or with his glove anymore. In fact, he practically insisted that they trade Geronimo. The other thing, the club wanted to make some changes on the coaching staff, and he felt the loyalty from him and through them back, the work they had done, he wanted to keep all of his coaches. So Wagner called him on the phone in California one day, and he said, I'm going to fly out. I want to meet you. I want to talk to you. And Sparky had made up his mind, I think, that if these other two things happened, that maybe he was going to quit. Now he says, what if he's coming out here and he's going to offer me a raise? What do I do now? Well, it was none of those, like multiple choice, A, B, C, or D, or none of the above. It was none of the above. He'd flown out there to fire him.
Well, he fired one of the best managers in baseball.
He really did, and I tell you, you got to give it to Johnny McNamara going in on that hot seat that he did, because you remember the opening weekend, the Giants went in there and obliterated them right in the Cincinnati ballpark. The fans there were hostile because Sparky was gone, because Pete Rose was gone. Boy, I tell you, the first time that Johnny went out to change a pitcher, McNamara, you'd have thought they were booing everybody that had ever been there over the years, and they were playing a record of all of it. Well, that club has turned around. They've had some injuries. He's moved his people around. They're getting better pitching than I think they ever dreamed of, especially with Seaver being hurt. And they're right up on the top of their division. So you got to give him some credit.
Yes, Bonham won a good game for him the other day.
Yes, he did. He's coming back from some problems, and he's not able to go nine. But with Bourbon and Bear out in their bullpen, you don't need to go nine anymore.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question. Let you speak for Chuck Tanner. We had a wild game here the other day between the Phillies and the Cubs. The final score was 23-22. Had to be one of the craziest games that was ever played. And the most home runs by both teams. Well, everything happened. Anyway, in the bottom of the final inning, Philadelphia was batting. There was two out. There was two strikes on Schmidt, who, as you know, owns this ballpark. He's hit more home runs here over the years than anybody. A lot of people had the opinion that Herman Franks should have walked him. And that would have put a man on third, a man on first, two out, uns are up. The count was 3-2. Now, that's why, to a home run hitter, you know and I know, if Babe Ruth or Gary knew had a count of 3-2, they know that next pitch.
Or Williams.
They're going to try to get that ball in the strike zone, and they're really ready for it. Well, this guy hit that ball a country mile. Somebody said, and a lot of people say, Frank should have put him on first base. What do you think Tanner would have done?
Well, I think he might have walked him, or he might have done another thing. He might have gone out and talked and said, look, I don't care what you do with this guy now that the count is 3-2, I don't care if you throw a ball up on the screen or if you throw one in the dirt or if you throw one 3 feet outside, but or even if you hit him.
Yeah.
But don't give him a pitch in the strike zone.
Yeah.
That's what I think Chuck would have done. Now, wait till I hear from Tanner.
Yeah.
No, that's what I think. Because I've heard him talk about similar situations, and that's the way you have to go. You have to base it on what he would have done in other situations similar to this. I wouldn't have given Schmidt a pitch in the strike zone there that he could have hit if he'd had a handful of bats instead of just one.
Well, it was a really sad ending to a ball game for all those loyal fans that sat out there and everybody thinking 3-2, why don't they walk this guy? Boom. And as soon as he hit it, you know it was gone.
Well, on the other side, as long as we're thinking about what you ought to do with pitchers and pinch hitters and the way you can come back at Wrigley Field, this and Fenway Park are two parks, if there ever were two, where no lead is safe. You know, boy, balls fly out of here, and some of the guys the Cubs have, and especially Kingman and Buckner and some of those guys, even Sizemore hit one yesterday. And what about yesterday, the way this club scored runs the day before, even though he used several pitchers, why make Kenny Holtzman stay out there for nine innings? You got a pinch hit just to make the fans think you care, don't you?
I would think so. I wondered why he let him stay in there for the whole game. And you know, the last time out, he pitched a marvelous ball game.
Had good stuff the first two innings yesterday. I thought he looked like the Holtzman of 10 years ago, because last year we saw him as a starter and in relief, and it just didn't look like he was the same Holtzman. But yesterday, he had good stuff, and he was popping that fastball occasionally, showing it to him. And I really thought the way he started out, he was going to be tough.
You said a lot of the hitters feel that one of his problems is that his pitches are predictable.
I kind of thought...
His pattern.
That's right. He pitches in patterns. That was his story when he was over at Oakland, even though he was a big winner. And he lives and dies with that. And if he's pitching great that day, he gets away with it. And if he isn't, he doesn't. But I think some of our hitters were guessing yesterday, and they were guessing right, because he is a pattern pitcher.
Our guest today is the voice of the Pittsburgh Pirates, an old working buddy of mine. We're delighted to have him, Milo Hamilton. We'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Milo Hamilton, the voice of the Pirates. You know, every time I think of Pittsburgh, I think of two wonderful characters that used to come in here and destroy Wrigley Field, Paul Wehner and Lloyd Wehner. And those guys used to enjoy a little pop once in a while. You know, they used to say if Paul Wehner had a couple of drinks, then he was really dangerous because he had no nerves at all. Well, at Wrigley Field, they used to get about 11 hits a weekend between them. Do they still talk about those guys in Pittsburgh?
Oh, sure they do. They are the legends of those great days, and both in the Hall of Fame and the batting averages they left and the characters that they were. You can't have a conversation very long without it. Remember, there was one story you have suggested that maybe a little libation was something they enjoyed once in a while, which was certainly true and would never be denied by either party. In fact, their batting averages were up in the 340s, 350s, 360s. And one year somebody suggested over the winter perhaps that one of them, if he wouldn't sniff that cork as often, he might even hit higher. And about Memorial Day, he was hitting 220, and they said, whatever you were doing, go right back to it, you know. So there were some characters, though, and they were two of them, no doubt about it. And I tell you, you think of those days and the clubs they played on and play all those day games and traveling on the trains like we did in those days. I wasn't around when they were there. I don't mean to imply that. And I never saw them actually playing a game as you did. But it was just almost automatic. If you played a series, you figured you'd see those guys on base between them, between hits and walks a dozen times.
You know, Paul told me down in Florida one time, he's gone now, but Lloyd is still living. And Lloyd was here when the Cubs had an old-timers day. And I had an interview with him, and I enjoyed seeing him so much. And I kidded him about that. I said, you know, Lloyd, they used to say that you and Paul used to drink an awful lot. He said, no, we didn't really drink that much. He said, we used to like to calm our nerves a little bit before we went to Wrigley Field.
Yeah, I'll say.
You know, Paul had a theory. Now, you see a lot of hitters today that do a lot of popping up. They pop up to short or they pop up a shallow outfield. And Paul Wehner maintains that hitters should swing at the top of the ball. He claimed he always, when the ball was coming in him, he always tried to hit the top of it rather than hit it in the middle or hit under it. And he claimed that's why he hit so many line drives. He seldom popped.
Well, and that makes you stay on top. It makes you, if you're a left-hand hitter, it makes you stay on top and bring that top hand over. Almost like Musial used to do, he almost used to roll that bat and force that ball into the... If he didn't hit a good line drive, he beat it into the ground and he had a chance to beat it out, or he had a chance to hit it between third and short, or if he pulled the ball between first and second. And that's absolutely right, because if you're popping it up and if you don't get it all, then it's just a pop-up. If you get it all underneath, why... It's gone.
I had breakfast the other morning with a mutual friend of yours and mine, a guy that I really love, Ted Williams, probably the greatest left-hand hitter that ever lived. Now, he's a great admirer of Kingman. I'm very fond of Kingman, too. I think Kingman is a terrific guy. Some people say, well, he's kind of a guy who likes to get off in a corner by himself. He's not very sociable. But I found him sociable, and I think he's a terrific hitter. Williams maintains that if Kingman had some... A better judge of the strike zone, and if he had more discipline at the plate and didn't swing it, he'd hit 60 home runs every year.
Well, he's an awesome hitter. He really is. And with those big long arms and the way he gets that bat around, and as you and I were talking driving out, I had Willie Stargell on my show yesterday, and we talked about that, about Kingman, that someday he'll hit a ball so far that the crowd in disbelief is going to stand there and there's almost going to be 30 seconds of silence. They're going to wonder if the ball's in orbit or if it landed up in Dyke Stadium or wherever in the world it lit. But he is an awesome hitter, and I'll tell you this from a broadcaster standpoint. You know, sometimes you have to wonder, is it going to be, and you've got to say it's going, and, oh, it's caught at the warning track or whatever. When he hits a ball, there's never any doubt. There's no front row home runs with him. It's over Waveland Avenue or the day before he hit one in the third apartment building on the porch or whatever. But you're right about Williams talking about him in the strike zone. Like, he hit the home run off us yesterday in the first inning to get the Cubs in front. And later in the game, he went after a breaking ball in the dirt and then struck out on a high fastball. Hitter like a Williams or an Aaron or a Billy Williams who used to be here, those kind of hitters or an Ernie Banks would not chase those kind of pitches. And if Kingman ever gets that down as to where, hey, you're not going to get me to swing at those bad balls. That'll do a couple of things for him. It'll mean that he's going to see more balls in the strike zone because they know they're not going to be able to get away with that anymore. And the other thing is, he's going to be more selective. And if they start walking him and the hitter behind him starts popping him out of there too, he can just make the whole club better. And I think he's improved. Bob Kennedy, you know, worked with him last year a couple times on some things, and you could see a difference. So I think he's teachable. I don't mean some hitters are stubborn. They won't listen to anybody. But I think he proved last year that he was listening, and Kennedy showed him a couple things. And if he'd cut down on those strikeouts, goodness knows how many home runs. And in this park, what better park could a home run hitter ever want to play in? Wrigley Field.
No, it's absolutely made to order. You know, Bill McGowan, a former great umpire in the American League, told me that he never saw Ted Williams swing at a pitch that was out of the strike zone. I used to swing at a pitch and miss, you know, but he never went outside the strike zone to swing.
Well, we've heard those stories from the old umpires that were behind the plate and the catchers. The stories are too many for them not to be true, because that's just how great a hitter he was. That's why he... when he walked and it was a borderline pitch, you hardly ever heard a squawk about it, because they felt if Williams didn't swing at it, it was a ball.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If they think it was on a corner, they'll squawk on a call and say, how could he take that pitch? Well, if Williams took it, it was ball four.
Now the umpire situation has been settled. We're all happy about it. But I kind of have a bit of sympathy for these guys that work these games. I think that they're honest. I think they really tried to do a good job. I think they took an awful lot of unnecessary abuse.
Well, they really did. They were put in an impossible position. A lot of these fellows have been amateur umpires, and some of them have been AAA, came up and were the crew chiefs. In a lot of instances, they were just simply overmatched. I tried to speak on this same subject on Friday's game when it was announced the settlement had come, trying to point out they had done a good job. Nobody questioned their honesty or their integrity. But I said, there are just some people who are overmatched in certain things. You wouldn't send a first-year med student to do a brain transplant, would you?
No.
Well, it's the same thing. You don't send amateur umpires to do big league games with all these high-priced, professional, outstanding big league ball players. And most of the arguments that we have seen, and boy, we've seen some buttes, we had three bench-clearing incidents in Atlanta a couple weeks ago, and the ball game got completely out of hand, and I've been told that that was one of the games that really triggered settling this thing. They just felt, we can't have any more. And it was the night that 10 people were thrown out of games all around the big leagues. You may remember that.
Yeah.
It was not only our park, it was like the moon was full that night, and everybody got thrown out, you know. But at any rate, nobody questioned their honesty, integrity. It was just a fact. They were put into a job they couldn't handle. They were, in fact, in Saturday's paper here, a couple of the amateur umpires admitted that they saw pitches in these big league games that they never knew existed, like Suter's split-finger fastball, Blylevin's curveball. The sinker ball pitchers have really suffered.
A guy like Rushel.
Rushel and Tekulve on our club, guys who count on getting that low ball pitch called a strike, they haven't been getting it.
Milo, it's been a delight having you as a guest on our show today. Be sure to give my very best to your family and your lovely family, your wife. I talked to her on the phone yesterday. And good luck to you and the Pirates. One of these days, I hope I'm still alive when I can come there and see you get into the Hall of Fame, because I know you're headed that way.
Well, it's really nice of you to say that, Bob, but I'm going to be the happiest guy in the world the day you go in, because, boy, they missed a real trick last year by not making you first. When the guy who did the most games of anybody and started all the things that you did in this game, the Hall of Fame has to have you there, and I just wish I was going to be able to be there, but you know I can't be, because I've got a doubleheader that day. And it's pretty hard. You know, you never got a doubleheader off. You used to do them alone.
That's right. I did them alone.
So have a great day that day, and I'll see you when we come back.
Thank you, Milo. Our guest has been Milo Hamilton. We'll be back right after this message. Tried to get out and see the ball game today between the Cubs and Pittsburgh. You know, the Cubs surprise you. They can really come up with a lot of hitting and a lot of power. One of the disappointments so far has been Reuschel, because he's a great pitcher. He's capable of winning 22, 23 ball games, And he's had an awful time. He's won two and lost five. So that pitching has been a problem, but pitching is a problem all over the league. White Sox have been had a pretty good trip out on the coast. They beat Oakland, but that's no trick. Oakland's got a real Bush League ball club out there. The Sox, too, need pitching. I think almost every club in baseball needs pitching. But the Yankees look to me like they're going to win it again. I was hoping they wouldn't. But anytime you got two guys like Tommy John and Goodrey, they'll probably win 58 games between them. Well, you've got a pretty good start on winning a championship. Anyway, if you can't get out and see the ball game, have a nice day. And now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next Sunday at our usual time.